Hello, welcome to Backwoods Belief. I'm Jeff Wright. I'm here with Ben. You're used to that setup, but today we have a special guest. Conley Owen has been gracious enough, I guess is the way I should say that, to join us to talk about his book, The Dorian Principle. And we are delighted to have Conley with us.
Gracious enough to join us for a second time, because we did try to record this episode before when you were away, and I'm used to you downloading the audio, so I forgot to download it, and by the time I got to it, it had expired. So this is the second attempt of recording with Conley, but I'm grateful that he was able to come back.
Yeah, this is a redo on the only lost episode of Backwoods Belief, so I'm glad to get that straightened out.
Nice. Yeah, I'm willing to come back on 7 times 70, but no more than that.
You're a gracious man. I appreciate that. Hey, Ben, so this was your idea. You had kind of thrown some ideas about what we could talk about. Would you like to start the interview off here and get the ball rolling?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing we should say is Conley, among many other great things he's done in his life, has written a book called The Dorian Principle, about, I guess, money and ministry and the way we do ministry and how money is involved with it. And it's a really fascinating book that touches on things that really nobody is talking about in the world of evangelicalism or Christianity in general that I've seen. And so I wanted to have him come on and just kind of talk about what the book's about, what the Dorian Principle is. And I think that would be a good place to start, to just define what the Dorian Principle is.
Yeah, sure. So the word Dorian is a Greek word that's probably usually pronounced differently if you're really trying to speak with some kind of academic pronunciation. But it is the Greek word that means freely. It's an adverb used in Matthew 10:8 and then also used in 2 Corinthians 11 by Paul. And Jesus says, freely receive, freely give. So it's basically that principle that ministry should be done freely. Now, a common question that people have is, well, you know, doesn't the Bible say the worker's worthy of his wages? And indeed, even later on in the next two verses, Jesus goes on to explain that the worker is worthy of his food. And in Luke, that comes out as the worker is worthy of his wages. So it's about holding those two truths together correctly, that ministry should be given freely. At the same time, it should be supported. So what I'm proposing here is a distinction between reciprocity and co-labor. Reciprocity being where the gospel is exchanged for something, usually money, and co-labor where it is being supported by something, usually money. You know, someone giving out of an obligation to God, not out of an obligation to man, in desiring to support that work. So that is in essence the Dorian principle, that support given as anything other than an act of co-labor compromises the sincerity of ministry.
What was the impetus for you to study this principle and then to eventually write the book?
Yeah, so if I can tell the long story here, it's something I've been interested in for a long time, because back, I guess a little bit before college, I got into open source software, which, if you're not familiar with what that is, open source software is software where you're allowed to see the way it works. Every other engineering discipline, you are able to reverse engineer something and you're not necessarily breaking any laws. You know, you can open the hood of your car, you can play around with it. Even if they sealed the hood of your car, you would be allowed to do that. But in software, if you do that, in the process, you end up making a copy, and so you're violating copyright law. So in order to support, you know, good engineering practices, a lot of organizations have made their software open source. And that means that you can, you know, freely get it. And I saw how a lot of projects were able to really thrive, and it didn't necessarily financially hurt the companies that would do this. Often it would actually benefit them. And so taking what I had seen pragmatically and then observing the way that the church still operated, where a lot of its resources were locked down and not shared freely, and I thought just very pragmatically, well, you know, maybe a lot of the benefits that I see in open source could be had in the church if they would embrace some of these models. But at the same time, I didn't know whether or not there was some kind of biblical principle that would require that. You know, I felt like if I were to say these things too strongly, I'd be binding consciences unnecessarily. But then over the years, as I have this in the back of my mind, I start seeing in Scripture a lot of things that apply. In fact, there are a few things Paul talks about as much as money and ministry. And so having that mindset where I'm kind of open to considering what the Bible says about these things and seeing that it actually does have a lot to say about the requirements and obligations we would saddle someone who's, you know, receiving ministry with, I realized there was a pretty significant overlap and I wanted to explore that. And as I did, I just discovered more and more and realized there was a real serious biblical principle here.
Could you talk a little bit more about in detail about what you mean by or how you distinguish reciprocity and co-labor? You mentioned it a little bit, but could you go into further detail on that?
Sure. So very simply, reciprocity is ministerial reciprocity is anytime ministry is exchanged for something else. You know, someone is giving to the minister out of an obligation because they gave something to them. Whereas co-labor is when someone gives out of an obligation to God, recognizing that the gospel is not coming from the minister, even if it's, you know, indirectly coming through him. It is coming from God. And so they give out of an obligation to God. Why should you support those who do the work of ministry? It's not because this invaluable thing comes from them, but rather because God is using them to supply that invaluable thing to people, to those who he is gracious to. So that's if you read the book, which is available at thedorianprinciple.org, Dorian is spelled Dorean. There are a ton of visualizations of a bunch of figures where there will be lines compared with triangles. Right, the line is where you know, on one side's a minister and one side's a recipient of ministry, and there's an exchange happening. Whereas with the triangle, there's this mediated obligation where someone is obligated to the minister, not directly, but because of their obligation to God, who is requiring of them that they support the work of ministry they give to the minister. So a question I usually get here is, well, isn't this just a matter of semantics or something like that? And, you know, sometimes that's the case, right? Like in a church service, when you give, yes, it is kind of a matter of semantics in that really we're just trying to exercise our minds to think rightly about this. You know, we're not giving to the pastor because he, you know, is owed this directly, but we're giving out of a thankfulness to God. However, in many cases, it's a lot more than just the mindset. It's all the earmarking that comes with the mindset, right? If you are selling, for example, let's just say conference tickets to come hear gospel preaching, right? You're saying, well, you can't actually hear any of this unless, you know, unless you pay me. And it very clearly earmarks it as a matter where, you know, the gospel is being exchanged for money. And so that opens up a can of worms of all the applications, because you begin realizing very quickly, wow, this has a lot of applications to all sorts of ways that ministry is conducted and funded.
You have anything you want to add, Jeff? Any questions?
Yeah, I'm curious about what kind of, it looks online, I guess I'll start here. It looks online like you have gotten a pretty warm reception in book reviews or Goodreads or wherever you see people kind of talking about the book. Have you gotten any negative pushback? Because I'm just thinking through, like, with religion and money, something's, you know, somebody out there is going to kind of gripe at that. You've already mentioned one question you run into. Are there any other sort of frequent feedback points you get on this idea when you put it in front of somebody for the first time?
Yeah, I guess those are two different questions. I guess I'll answer them separately, but have we gotten negative feedback? Yeah, absolutely. However, what you find is that people aren't that willing to engage. I think a lot of people recognize that there's more substantial stuff here than that they really are able to parse out. And so kind of the limits of the objections that I get is, well, I think you're taking it too far. Or a lot of people, you know, report back that, you know, they show this to their pastor and their pastor says, well, he's taking it too far. But then once you try to go beyond that to the substance, a lot of times there's not a lot of specifics given. And honestly, I would love it if there were some, you know, particularly maybe some kind of high profile or well-known pastor who is willing to engage with me on this, because so far, you know, those who have rejected it have been fairly unwilling to engage with it at all, which I think honestly is a testimony to the fact that there is something substantial here to be considered, that it's not so easily dismissed.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quote that we often use on this podcast from Upton Sinclair, that it's difficult to get a man to understand something that his salary depends on him not understanding. And so I imagine that's why you don't hear a lot of substantial engagement with the argument, because if you're right, it means these people need to find a new line of income.
Right. Yeah. And I imagine if this starts threatening anyone in a way where they feel like they need to respond to it, that's when, you know, we'll start hearing real responses. But yeah, until then, I don't know. It's funny because if you read the book, you realize it's very, I think it's very charitably written. And, but at the same time, I'm feeling like, well, this is important. And if this is going to go anywhere, maybe I need to start poking bears. Cause it's interesting how, unwilling people are to engage too seriously with it.
That was one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. And, you know, we don't have a huge follower base at this point, but just to get these ideas out there, because I do think you're onto something, and I think it's something worth talking about. You know, even if over time somebody does come up with a substantial like argument against it, it's at least worth hearing the argument and dealing with it, because I think it's a good one. And just to leave it unengaged is not going to be helpful.
Right.
But yeah, if you want to go ahead and answer the second part of Jeff's question there.
Yeah, so the second part of the question was, what's the common pushback that I usually get? So I guess the number one piece of pushback is just misunderstanding, you know, what I'm saying, as though I'm suggesting that the worker's not worthy of his wages, or that you shouldn't support ministry, or something like that. Definitely not saying any of those things, or that people should fund all sorts of, or not fund, but people should run all sorts of ministry without asking for money or having any hope of, you know, someone supporting them or working with them in that. Definitely not saying any of those things. Some of the more reasonable aspects, I guess. One thing is that certainly there are gray areas in application, and I think a lot of people focus in on the gray areas and then decide that this can't be a worthwhile principle because there are gray areas, right? So what does count as ministry? Because I'm not saying that you know, if anything with a Bible verse on it shouldn't be sold, right? Like if you all know In-N-Out, the burger chain out here in California. They have a Bible verse on the bottom of their cups, right? And so am I saying that In-N-Out soft drink should be free? That's, you know, that's not what I'm saying. The essence of what's being sold there is a soft drink. The fact that, you know, they out of some religious conviction have decorated it with a Bible verse, that doesn't then, you know, invalidate it as being something secular that can be sold. And now it's something sacred that can't be. And so if you consider this for a second, like, let's say I have a birthday card, and I have written on it a Bible verse, you know, at the end. Well, okay, that's the essence of what's being sold is a birthday card, so that could be sold. Now, let's say you added another Bible verse. Now you've got two on there, and then you add another and another. And eventually, we get to a point where we've got a birthday card that has the whole Bible in it. You know, at what point did did we go from selling a birthday card to selling a Bible? I don't know where that line is drawn. And there's a second issue here, which I'm not really addressing, which is the fact that there is a difference between selling the ideas themselves and selling a physical thing that that is married to the idea, which I guess we can address that in a second too. But all these gray areas, a lot of people latch onto that and say, well, because there are gray areas, therefore this can't be a worthwhile principle. But you find with many of the principles that we embrace, there are gray areas. If your listeners are familiar with the regulative principle of worship, you know, many Reformed believers understand that, and I mean, this is kind of definitional to being Reformed, is you understand that there's a regulative principle of worship, that God regulates worship. Worship should only be what he requires and nothing more. And there's a distinction between forms and elements, right? The form being the way that you worship, you know, whether you're standing or sitting, and the element being, oh, okay, we're praying or we're singing. And that distinction means that there's freedom in forms, but there is not freedom in the elements. Now, different people differ on what's a form and what's an element, right? Some people might say that, well, instruments are a form. Some people might say that instruments are an element, and therefore, you know, because the Bible doesn't command them, we're not allowed to use them. Not in the New Testament anyway. And but hopefully, you know, any Reformed believer recognizes that the fact that there are some areas that people disagree on, or may even be gray, does not make the principle useless or just worth neglecting. Rather, you know, you just have to...
Yeah, it doesn't invalidate the rule.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I'm proposing is a principle, and I get later on, you know, in the book to applications, and a lot of people really focus on those applications and say, well, he took it too far. You know, it's possible. It's possible I have. I don't think I have. It's possible. But I would still hope that people would be able to embrace this distinction between reciprocity and co-labor and recognize that God has forbidden one and encouraged and commended the other. So that's one substantive critique that I've gotten. Trying to think if there are, I suppose there are a number of others, but you know how substantive.
And that critique itself is really more about how do we practically apply it, and less about is this principle real and true,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, another common one is that this is not that a lot of the verses that I'm honing in on are particular to that time. Like, for example, you know, Jesus said, freely you receive, freely give, when he's sending out the disciples. Well, how do we know that that applies to disciples today? Because, you know, he was talking about them doing miracles and all kinds of things. And so why does that apply to us today? And the answer I'd give to that is there was an Anglican divine named Jeremy Taylor who, in discussing hermeneutics, pointed out this verse and how so many people are willing to say that it doesn't apply today because it was talking about miracles and other things that should be freely given. And not just to preaching. And he said, there is an eternal proportion and rectitude to this. You know, those are the words he's using, basically describing, it's not just that Jesus said, freely give, but he gave the reason behind it. And he said, freely you have received, freely give. So that principle applies no matter what the case is, right? Just like later he said, I'm sending you out in the midst of wolves, you know, be as wise as serpents and gentle as doves. All these things, we're very ready to apply to ourselves today, in as much as they do apply, right? And because he's giving reasons, you know, we're still sent out in the midst of wolves. It's still the case that the gospel has been freely received. So it's still the case that it should be freely given.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Conley, can I ask what tradition, denomination you're in?
Yeah, I'm a Reformed Baptist. I'm one of the pastors at Silicon Valley Reformed Baptist Church. So we're a 1689 confessing church.
Oh, good man. So if I can just flesh this out, I'm guessing a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar. I think there's probably going to be some quite a bit of overlap between you know, the ministry that you've done and what they like to read and whatnot. But just in case, can we flesh this out in real world experience a couple different ways to help newbies kind of get their head around it. Critique my summary here. So in the context of a local church, am I right in understanding that you would have a minister show up with no expectation of any set financial, I guess I would use the term compensation, that would be spiritually unhelpful. The minister comes to offer the word freely, and the congregation is glad to receive it. They will in some way financially, being part of that, they will in some way support the ministry of the church. And as a Baptist, other groups would do it different ways, but as a Baptist, the congregation may decide that the minister should receive some support for his ministry at a certain amount of the money they receive in, you know, from the members as a general support of the ministry. Is that right? Or have I missed something important there?
Certainly there's an implication with this kind of generosity that you would, trust the hand of God to support you as he is the, Jesus talks about praying that laborers would go out into the harvest. And part of what I'm arguing for here is that, the employer in this situation is the Lord of the harvest and not the field. So you trust the Lord of the harvest to supply. At the same time, this is not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that, if God's called you to ministry, you do it no matter how much poverty you encounter. what you see in Acts 18, Paul is ministering part-time and working part-time. And when people from Macedonia, specifically most people understand this to be, you know, speaking of the Church of Philippi, and the implication being, especially if you look at the letter to the Philippians, that they brought money with them. Then he begins laboring full time, right? And so Paul is not saying, okay, I have to work full time no matter how much no matter how much poverty I encounter. Rather, I will work as much as I'm reasonably able to. And when I'm supplied with more, well, then I will be able to do more work. So I think it's perfectly right for a man to decide that, you know, he won't receive a call, you know, using that terminology, if it comes without the support that would be needed in order to make it practical for his family. So there's a chart that I give near the end of the book with several circles. And I talk about receiving, requiring, and there's one more aspect to it. Receiving, requiring, and requesting, right? So reciprocity is always forbidden. It doesn't matter if you receive it and it was voluntarily given, right? Like if someone says, for example, I have an issue with receiving in the context of counseling. So in the context of counseling, you know, it's very clear you're ministering to a particular person. When they're giving, it seems to me that it's very clearly earmarked as a reciprocity, right? That they're giving back because you gave them something. So even receiving that, even if you haven't requested it, it's still a problem. Because some people understand me as saying, well, as long as it's voluntary, it's okay. That's not what I'm saying. If it's ever reciprocity, it's wrong, right? If it's been requesting reciprocity, right? If you say suggested donation for something, you know, basically you're saddling someone with a sense of obligation, even if you're just requesting it that way. And then requiring it where you say, oh, you know, in order to read this tract or whatever, you have to pay me. So receipt, request, and requirement are all wrong with reciprocity. However, every single one of those is acceptable, perfectly acceptable when it comes to co-labor. So you can imagine someone saying, first of all, with receipt, someone sees the good work that you're doing and wants to support that, and they come and they you know, give you funds in order to support that ministry. That's perfectly acceptable. If you, just like Paul, point out the good work you are doing and request that people assist you in that work, that's totally acceptable. And if you require it, once again, like Paul in that situation in Acts, and you say, you know, I am not going to be able to work full time or maybe even part time unless you work alongside of me, that would be perfectly acceptable. So the distinction here is not between voluntary and asking for things or even demanding things. It's the difference, like I said, between all of this being out of an obligation to the Lord or being out of an obligation to man. So hopefully that, I know that was a bit rambly, but hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think through the practicalities, experientially. Our own church covenant says that, you know, one of the things the members agree to do is support the work of the ministry, but they, you know, it doesn't say support the salary of the ministers. I've always had, I'm very hands-off with the way our church handles money because I don't want any room for accusation, but I've also had this sense of like, I'm not going to ask for a particular salary. I'm not going to talk about giving, supporting me because I kind of want the financial, I want the freedom to say what needs to be said without feeling like I would offend a donor base. So in your system, a man takes a call to be the preaching elder at a congregation. And in that process, they say, this amount of money is what we had in mind as regular compensation. Would you say appropriate or inappropriate?
Yeah, I think it's appropriate for both of them to, you know, speak about what what's needed. The way I see this is as a financial partnership, right? There's the word, it depends on which translation you're reading, but translated either partnership or fellowship in Philippians, koinonia. A lot of times we think about that word as being, you know, the sort of just getting along with each other, having a good time, fellowship, right? But in the Bible, that's used as a term for business partners, you know, and I think it's totally right for business partners to talk hard facts about what the, what the requirements are here to make a joint venture work. So there are ways that can be done more crassly or less crassly, but I do think that it's, that it's right to have those sorts of conversations. And I think it is good for ministers to lead their people through that. You know, I just mentioned the 1689 Confession, which says in the Westminster Confession doesn't have a section on this, but it actually talks about the importance of ministers being paid so that they can labor full time, ideally. And, you know, if I think it is, like I said, it could be, you could do this crassly, or you could do this in a way that saddles them with obligations they shouldn't have. But I think it's right for a pastor to lead them even through thinking about this matter, because otherwise, who's going to lead them in thinking about this? Either they've looked at those passages or they haven't.
Yeah. And it sounds like a big part of that distinction is going to be the understanding of the congregation and the pastor when they come to make that agreement that you are agreeing to pay me this money, not in return for the preaching of the gospel and the, you know, the sacraments and all of that, as a, like, you're paying me to do this for you, but rather you're paying me so that I can do this labor for the Lord from which you are going to freely benefit.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's a joint venture. Like I said, you know, we're called to gather together and proclaim the gospel in our particular areas. And in order for that to be done effectively, ideally one person is going to spend a lot of their time on it, dedicating themselves to the word of God in prayer. And so to enable one person, other people sacrifice what they have. And the way Paul talks about this, it's very fascinating. You look at his lists of hardships that he undergoes, where he talks about being beaten and struck and all kinds of things, shipwrecked, right? There's three different lists where he does that. And each one of them, he also lists working with his hands doing a little bit of work counts anything like the others. But that's the idea, is it does. The fact that he works and that doesn't get to enjoy the fruit of his labor because he's spending it on ministry costs means that when someone comes alongside the minister and gives up the fruit of their labor, they're basically engaging in the same shared suffering, right? They might not be beaten with rods. Mm. They might not be shipwrecked, but they're joining in that list of hardships so that the minister can do his work. And that's why in 3 John, it makes that claim that you're fellow workers for the truth. And, you know, consider the reciprocity co-labor distinction there. 3 John 7-8 says, "For they have gone out for the sake of the name, not accepting anything from the Gentiles," right? No reciprocity. "Therefore, we ought to be supporters of people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth." So therefore, co-labor. Right? They have not taken reciprocity, therefore we should co-labor with them. We should, you know, engage in this hardship of not getting to enjoy all the fruits of our labor so that we can work alongside of them in this.
And so I know that your book also talks about parachurch ministries. It's something Ben and I both would like to talk to you about that. But I guess the last kind of thinking about it at the local church level, have you thought, and it may not have any, but have you thought about any implications this has for the minister's relationship or the church's relationship to the state in taxation? Does this change anything, or is that kind of secondary and off to the side of the Dorian principle?
That is a very good question. I read, now I don't know how related it is to the Dorian principle, but I have I have some thoughts on this. I read a statement from a Baptist church during the American Revolution that made the claim that if the government were to tax them, that it would not be right for them to give those taxes, mm-hmm. because it would basically be showing a submission of God to the government, which you shouldn't be willing to state. And I found that very interesting. That's always been in the back of my mind. So yeah, thinking about how the Dorian principle makes statements about obligations, maybe there's something to be said there, but I that's about the extent of my thinking on this.
Sure. Well, you mentioned in your book, and Ben, if it's okay with you, we'll pivot to parachurch. You mentioned in your book sort of looking at the Gospel Coalition. I think it was $300 for a live stream. I think G3 recently launched a monthly subscription service that seems something like a Disney Plus subscription. You get their content, or free access to all their you get open access to all their content for this monthly subscription service. Again, your book fleshes that out, but if somebody's listening who hasn't, could you walk us through how we should think about parachurch ministry in light of this principle?
Right. So parachurch ministry is the main application here in a lot of ways, because you know, we were just talking about the local church and how it applies to our thinking about what we are doing. But parachurch ministry is where it really comes down to the clear out-and-out transgressions. Because in local church ministry, there's already a model for fundraising, right? The congregation is giving on a weekly basis. They are laboring alongside with the ministers of the gospel. They're laboring together in their giving. And even if they're not necessarily thinking about it exactly rightly, that's what they're doing. When it comes to parachurch ministry, because you don't have that fundraising model, you have to start getting creative. And the very typical way of being creative is to start selling things. And when you are selling things, that is the reciprocity issue, right? And you are engaging in reciprocity where you're exchanging ministry for money or some other benefit. So that is my key in focusing on parachurch ministry. In the chapter where I address that in chapter 12, is basically that not that parachurch ministry is in and of itself wrong, but I think it was Carl Truman that said the road to hell is paved with parachurch ministries. You know, the idea being that there's so many good intentions in parachurch ministries, but those good intentions don't necessarily flesh themselves out into good results. Yeah, it's with parachurch ministries that we have to make sure that we're not selling something, because there's typically not the same kind of temptation in local church ministry to sell things.
Yeah. Ben, I hate to keep, you know, asking question after question. I've got some more stuff on my mind about this, but what's burning in your mind as we're listening?
I was going to, in the context of parachurch ministry, you have to think about not only the selling of with parachurch ministries, it's not just because parachurch ministries are essentially a business. It's not a ministry, you know, in the sense that a local church ministry is. And so you have a lot of difficulty in sort of sussing out, all right, am I paying a business for a product? And is that a legitimate form of reciprocity where that product is something like a lecture series on church history or a lecture series through the book of Philippians or something like that. And you get into a lot of sticky, like you're saying, the gray practical areas of application where it's, you know, you could have a person who goes to a parachurch ministry and says, well, you're providing this material and I think it's beneficial to the church and I'm a member of the church who has benefited from it. So is my patronizing your business not a kind of co-laboring in that work?
Right. I have had a number of people say that they're co-laboring with someone when they do that. It's just not framed that way, right? And if they tell you that you can't even have this unless you pay me, you know, even if you want to call it something different, it very clearly is earmarked as reciprocity. And consider Paul's response when the Corinthians wanted to pay him or the Thessalonians wanted to give him food. He determined that these were, my understanding of these passages is that he determined these were reciprocal situations. And so he refused. He didn't say, okay, well, we'll count this as co-labor. He just refused. So yeah. And I go into lots of examples where Paul is sometimes receiving, sometimes refusing funds, and why I see each one where he's refusing as a reciprocity, each one where he's accepting as co-labor.
Yeah. And so it is both a mindset thing for one. Two, I think in Paul's case, and probably ought to be in ours in more situations than we like to think, he's concerned about his name, his reputation as a minister of the gospel. It's like, if I can be seen as taking money for giving you the gospel, I don't want to be seen that way, even if it's not necessarily that way.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, he makes this very clear with this comparison of himself to the super apostles, because they were willing to receive funds from the Corinthians in the same context in which he had refused them. Now, there were plenty of contexts where he had accepted funds from the Corinthians, but in the context where he refused, the super apostles were receiving, and he said he would never, you know, he could never do this because he needs to distinguish himself from these false teachers.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, well, that's just as long as the super apostles were there. If they were gone, he would have taken the money because then he wouldn't have needed to distinguish himself. It's like, well, what kind of distinguishing are we talking about here? It's like, You know, it's not like he's wearing one colored hat and they're wearing another colored hat. It's he's distinguishing himself as a true teacher by doing the things that a true teacher does, which is to not receive this reciprocal funding in exchange for the gospel.
So, and this is a great place to park for a minute. Would you argue then, and I think we talked about this last time, or maybe it's in the book itself, but that this is actually a mark of a true teacher versus a false teacher, is whether they're willing to receive reciprocity.
Yes, absolutely. I guess the only caveat I would give is that the Bible speaks in these stark contrasts. I think, you know, when it comes to application, I'm not saying everyone who receives one penny in reciprocity is therefore to be condemned as a false teacher. We live in an era where it's just rampant, even among, you know, some of the best teachers. And I'm not trying to condemn them outright, even though I do think their actions need addressing. But the way Scripture sets it up and speaks of this, you know, Jesus says you can either serve God or money. And that you just see Paul give countless examples of what the false teacher is doing. And, you know, and what is driving him is a love of money. And I do believe that Scripture expresses this as the defining mark of a false teacher, right? If they are, and if you think about it, it makes sense, even just definitionally so. A false teacher is doing things not for the sake of God, but for the sake of himself. And whether that for the sake of himself is money or some other kind of benefit to him, it's still really all the same. And whereas the one who is doing this sincerely out of the love of God is not doing it for his own personal benefit.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a whole chapter I have written on that, because it is kind of paradigm shifting what I'm talking about. Because a lot of people think about, you know, I have this Venn diagram in there, right? That some greedy teachers are false and some false teachers are greedy. But what I'm saying, the biblical view is that, you know, this is how you're supposed to identify false teachers. And we live in an era where it's kind of hard to do because the false teachers are acting as greedy ones. But yeah, this should be the defining feature.
Appreciated the part in that chapter too, where you noted that parachurch ministries can, you know, virtually always be ran as just a ministry of the local church. There's nothing inherently requiring, you know, a given parachurch ministry to function outside of the authority of the local body of elders and the accountability of a congregation. I have a friend who has run a parachurch ministry for a long time. I've benefited a lot from the material generated by that ministry. But when we talk, there's clearly a sort of, you know, I'm summarizing him. He may want to push back on this, but there's this sense of like, well, the local church really has some problems and the parachurch should be able to step into that and sort of correct some of the problems of the local church. And I'm like, man, brother, that's so messed up. That is so backwards in terms of how God is accomplishing his work. And, you know, the point that I make in those conversations is the promises aren't given to the parachurch organization. The gates of hell can restrain a parachurch organization. And in fact, I think you can see in this last 4 or 5 year period, the gates of hell have made some pretty good gains against some notable parachurch ministries. But, you know, bring that under the auspices of the local church and God's relationship to that ministry is going to change as well in a way that's beneficial. So anyway, that's just praise for that section in your book.
Part of people's concern is that, well, you can get things done a lot faster in a parachurch ministry, right? And the church is just a little too cumbersome. But all those cumbersome aspects of it were set up on purpose. You know, the fact that, okay, we should have deacons who meet certain qualifications. And you create a parachurch ministry where you've got people dealing with the finances who have not met those qualifications. Well, yeah, you're gonna end up having problems.
Yeah. One thing you said a minute ago is, you know, if we started to apply this principle, it would affect a lot of ministries, even, you know, ministries that we consider good and helpful to us. And that makes me think of one thing I've said in the past is that if we applied, for instance, the qualifications of deacons and elders to the extent that Scripture actually gives those qualifications, we would probably in the short term see a large number of churches without pastors, without deacons. But ultimately, God would bless that obedience. And I think that's one thing to think about. You know, assuming that the Dorian principle is right and true, if we actually applied it and, you know, treated those people who are not doing their ministry according to it, it might in the short term have some pretty obvious, like, I don't want to say negative effects, but it would have some drastic effects on the church. But how much would God bless that obedience to it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people get concerned because they realize that their, you know, ministry of whatever variety is violating this, and they think, well, this is the way I get funding, so you're basically saying that I shouldn't get funding. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, the funding should come through the right means. And if you think about it, yeah, it would hurt in the short term, but anything that's worth supporting, you know, God would send the co-laborers to fund it. A lot of seminaries are already running through a large number of donations. You know, if they stopped accepting tuition, yeah, their numbers financially would go down for a season. But as more people are benefiting from it and, you know, really appreciating it, I think you would find that people would be more eager to give.
Yeah. And you would probably actually, in doing that, give opportunity for people to be blessed by their giving that they didn't have before. Like they would have the outlet to bless and be co-laborers with these guys studying for ministry in a way that they hadn't.
That's right. Yeah. And something, you know, I often point out in these discussions is when I purchase a book, or, you know, let's say I get a book on Kindle, right? Like someone studied the word, wanted to share these treasures with me, but only for the cost of $9.99, and I pay that. I don't feel any kind of obligation to pray for this person. I don't feel, you know, any kind of obligation to hold them accountable. I don't feel any kind of blessing in, you know, having supported them. None of that. However, if I am out of a appreciation for this person's work, co-laboring with them by giving to them, you know, I'm going to feel the need to pray for them. I'm going to feel the need to hold them accountable when they start going off the rails. You know, I'm going to have that sense of blessedness that God is using me and what he's given me to fund the work of building the kingdom. And so, yeah, those are great blessings. Like, what do you get more excited over, you know, making an investment in some stock that you know is going to do really well, or do you get more excited about paying bills? You know, there's a big difference between those two.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, that's a great illustration. So one of the things that Ben and I had talked about was thinking through the digital world. So, you know, podcasts go out largely for free through distribution hubs like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Are there other digital ministries that you've thought about, hey, this would have a profound impact upon that? I mean, we've talked about digital books, print books, and now podcasts. Anything else?
Yeah, you also mentioned live streaming conferences, so that's another one. Seminaries, you know, we've talked about that a little too. Those are a lot of the main ones, and we haven't really parsed out here, you know, how this applies to things where there's something physical being sold versus something that's purely just information, and you know, that might be worth talking about some, but. Yeah, there's basically just all kinds of things, and there's all kinds of ways that this can violate too. I don't know if this is what you had in mind with podcasts, but you know, a lot of podcasts will, you know, if you give extra money on their Patreon, they'll give you extra teaching. You know, Jesus said that he gave all his teaching openly. Not that he didn't spend some time alone with the disciples, but you know, all his teaching was open. He wasn't saying, "Oh, you know, if you pay me, then I'll give you the good stuff." Yeah, that wasn't how he operated.
Yeah, I think it's just so foreign to us to think that way, which is a tragedy, really. But with all of the kind of in the last 10 years, the explosion of, you know, self-publishing, of podcasting, just like the hurdle to get into creating content has the bar has lowered so much, and we're all just kind of storming the gates to get in there and to get our piece of that pie without thinking about what the consequences are to our ministries when we do things like, you know, upcharging for the good stuff, like you said. And there's just so much of that we really have not thought through. And I think I think the last time we talked about this, you talked about how this has actually been something that's come up over and over again throughout history. And if you could go kind of cover that again, that would, I think, would be helpful.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, and this is an area that I'd like to do a lot more research in, because there's so much to look at, especially when you look through how much the church dealt with simony being the sale of ordination. A lot was written on that. Some of it being with a general eye towards other ways that this could be violated, most of it being specific to ordination, which makes it harder to sift through for what's useful. But yeah, early on in the church, and I do write about this in the book, early on in the church, there were examples of people charging for prophecy, people charging for teaching directly. And you have early church documents like the Didache that warn about this and say that this is the practice of a false teacher and you should reject someone who's doing this. Later on, you have the sale of ordinations, you know, simony, like I talked about. Then you have a lot of selling relics that was also eventually condemned more strongly. And then, of course, what started the whole Reformation was the sale of indulgences, where you're selling, you know, of course, from a Reformed understanding, this is an entire fictitious thing that's being sold, but let's pretend it were a real spiritual benefit. You know, selling spiritual benefits for money is what upset Luther so much here at first, before, you know, he began getting into the details.
Or he realized it was all fake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm not a Luther historian, so I may have misspoken there. But then there are a lot of examples after this too. You know, it was very common in the English-speaking world for two centuries to have pew rents. So it was considered distasteful to pass a plate. Mm-hmm. And the alternative to this was charging rent for a pew. So, you know, if you want a particular pew up close or in the back, you know, like James 2 explicitly says not to do, you could pay a certain amount of money and you would get a pew and you would, and you'd have your name put on that pew and that was yours. And you would, and that was how the church would raise its money. So in each of these eras, you know,
there's a great point to be made there, which is this was like, if I remember correctly, New England, that was pretty standard practice. Was it practice in England as well to do the pew rentals?
Yes, that's correct. One of my favorite books on this was written by someone who was very high up in the Church of Scotland, who was dealing with it in his own denomination, that it was so prevalent. And he's pointing out basically a lot of the same passages I am about just how wrong this is.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just incredible. You know, if we think about ourselves and our time and you're looking at this and you're like, but this just seems so normal. This is what everyone's doing. Well, just consider how normal this crazy practice to us was back then.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to say. That was a standard practice. And, you know, we look at James 2 and we're like, well, obviously you shouldn't be doing it. It says right here not to do this. But to them, it was just part of the world they lived in. And that's a good sort of warning to ourselves. Like, just because something seems obviously part of the world that we're living in doesn't necessarily mean that we ought to be doing it.
Right. And so one question people have here is, well, what was going on back when, you know, people have been selling books for a long time, right? So, you know, am I trying to point out something that people just missed for centuries? I do think the modern problem that we're dealing with is, well, you know, if we're talking about digital things, especially only 50 years old, but even selling books is really only a 300-year-old problem. Because if you look back prior to the 1700s, what would happen is that you've got, and I've got quotes from a book on this. Generally, let me gather my thoughts here. Sorry. Authors were writing only to get the word out, right? And then publishers were picking up and printing what would be what they thought would sell and be valuable. So you have these secular printers printing things, right? And they might be picking up religious books because they know that's going to sell, but they're operating a very secular business, right? They're printing, they're just a you know, an industry, right? Whereas the author is not actually selling his work. He's being funded by patrons, right? You know, he might make a dedication to the queen or some duke, and that person will then fund the work because they appreciate this work that's being done. And this is very different than what happens since 1710, which is the first modern copyright law, the Statute of Anne, is passed. And at that point, it becomes possible for authors to make contracts about getting royalties, right? And so at that point, authors are able to start selling their writings the way that we think of authors selling their writings, where, you know, it's actually the ideas themselves that are being treated as property that can be exchanged for money, even though property traditionally has been something that's scarce, right? But suddenly now you have property that can be infinitely reproducible and is being sold. And so this issue is really only 300 years old. So yeah, I am trying to point out a fairly recent thing that I think is just, you know, this is just our generation's issue to solve now.
Yeah.
If I could point out one more story here. I was recently reading a biography about Luther that focused on his printing endeavors, and he was offered an opportunity to basically get more money than he had ever made as a yearly salary if he would give this one publisher first shot at printing his work. So not even exclusive rights, because those didn't exist back then, but just, you know, a guarantee that he would give them the manuscript prior to anyone else getting the manuscript, right? You give us the manuscript, once we publish, everybody can republish this, but, you know, just give it to us first and we will pay you more money than you have ever made. And he said no, because he did not want to be a peddler of the word of God. And man, all these people today, you know, are Reformed brothers and sisters who look up to Luther as the guy, you know, but are engaging in far worse deal than he was offered, and don't consider it anything close to peddling the word of God, but it is. It's far worse than even what he was offered.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Conley, I was going to, and I guess this will kind of empty my bag on questions. I so appreciate your time here today. You're distributing the Dorian principle. You're doing it with you know, the cost to maintain a website where people can get it in various different forms. I know I saw at the last G3 I went to a print copy. How has practicing this principle worked in your own ministry? You know, are you receiving the kind of compensation needed? I say compensation. It's a hard habit to break. Are you receiving the sort of support for the ministry and partnership in the ministry that allows it to keep going without it being a financial burden?
Yeah, in part that's because, you know, God really has blessed me. He's blessed the church. He's blessed the one ministry that we're partnering with, First Love Publications, which is that's a bunch of churches working together to do publishing ministry as well as some other things. So my church funded the printing of it, and then First Love is funding the distribution of it. So and then, you know, all kinds of various individuals are funding the churches that are funding these things. So yeah, this is just co-labor, right? I think I have given some money to it to ship some big boxes overseas, but apart from that, this has all been, you know, my church and various other churches working together for this. You know, a lot of people, like I said, when I point this out, they say, well, I don't know how I'd ever be able to fund something like this, or we'd ever be able to fund something like this as a church. Well, work together with other churches. And if, you know, if it turns out that no one cares about this enough to fund it, maybe it's not actually worth doing. But anyway.
Yeah, well, praise the Lord. Glad to hear that.
One thing I wanted to think through, and we've already kind of talked about it a little bit, but the Dorian principle itself, you know, freely you've received, freely give, is not I think people might be hearing this podcast and be like, well, you guys just don't want, you know, ministers to have money. But that's a principle that works both ways. It's not just for the minister, but it's also for the people. Like, you have freely received the gospel. You freely received this teaching. You freely received all of these benefits of Christ, you know, ministered through a minister. So freely give to that ministry and become co-laborers with him. Don't just leave him out, you know, hanging to dry.
Right. That's absolutely
for sure.
Right. Yeah. This comes with a impetus, a encouragement to co-labor. You know,
yeah.
Once you realize this distinction exists, it, you know, just like we were talking about the joy, the blessing of giving, it just gives all that much more reason for it.
One thing we often like to end our episodes with is sort of a practical application of the ideas we've been talking about. And so if you were to come across, you know, somebody who's like, you know, I just can't afford to do this. You know, all of my work, taking care of my family is predicated on my, you know, receiving money for the work that I do. how would you encourage somebody to start thinking about becoming more obedient in this way?
Yeah, I guess depending on the person's actual situation, I'd have different things to say. You know, if maybe they've got a lot of avenues to start seeking, co-labor, all right, people who would partner with them in ministry. And maybe, a lot of people feel like they're on the other end of this, right? They feel that they're not allowed to do that. That would be too greedy to ask people for help. But part of what I'm pointing out here is this should free people up to ask for help, because there's nothing wrong with co-labor, right? There's nothing wrong with even like encouraging it very aggressively, as Paul did. So, there are a lot of people who out of conviction are bivocational pastors that don't need to be, and this gives them the freedom to really encourage their church to fund the work, because it's not for themselves that they're asking, it's for the Lord that they're asking. And, but now let's say someone is, they don't have those kinds of avenues to work with, then I would say that this is in a way, this kind of providence is to be read, is to be interpreted as an indication that the Lord of the harvest does not intend to fund this work right now. And as our first obligations are to our families, beyond any kind of special ministry that God might call us to, we should take that as an indication that maybe for this season, we can't do this full time or even part time, just like Paul, right? Just like Paul, yeah, for a season, did not work full time.
Yeah, I think that's a good insight. Do you have anything else, Jeff, that you want to add?
No, I think this has been very helpful, and I appreciate, again, Conley, you giving us so much time today.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find that book on, what is it, thedorianprinciple.org?
Yes.
And how much are you charging for it now?
Well, for listeners here, I'll give it half off. just use the discount code Backwoods.
The discount code Backwoods Belief. Yeah. There you go. for Patreons, you can get a further 25%.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, it's free. And not only are the digital copies free, and there is a podcast version of it. You can just, search it in your podcatcher and listen to it audio. But there's even a print copy that's free. You don't have to type in any information other than the shipping information. And First Love Publications will ship you one for free. So, please check it out, share a copy with your pastor. And I'll also add that since publishing this about 2 years ago, I guess now, a number of people have gotten interested. And in particular, there's a couple of guys who have really banded together with me to push this forward. And they've created this site called sellingjesus.org, where a lot of this activity is happening. So you want to check that out, sellingjesus.org, and the podcast that they've got going over there. And if you're on Facebook, there's a group called Money and Ministry where we're having some of these discussions as well. So if you're interested in this topic, you can check us out at those places.
Excellent.
Nice. Yeah, I really do think that this book and just this idea is paradigm shifting for a lot of ministries, and would be if they, one, knew about it, and two, we're willing to sit down and deal with the substance of it. So I'm really thankful for you doing the work, because I think this is going to be a blessing to the church.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, and just, I guess we've already sort of talked about this, but to think about it as paradigm shifting, once again, I do think I'm offering a distinction and a clarity that hasn't been there in the past. At the same time, I don't think I'm saying anything new.
Right. Yes.
I do believe that the church in ages past has addressed this, and you need more clarity in each season. Luther needed more clarity to deal with indulgences, but you don't need that much clarity to deal with indulgences. It's pretty obvious to a lot of people that that's wrong. And but now we're in an era where more clarity is needed, and maybe in the future even more clarity will be needed. So I'm just looking to push forward that bar of clarity in an area that I think the church has already had a lot of agreement on in ages past.
Yeah, especially with just the way the world has changed so much in the last 100 years or more, with publishing being so accessible and now digital media being so accessible. This is certainly a needed area of needed clarity.
For sure. For sure.
All right. You want to take us out, Jeff?
Yeah, so guys, thanks for listening to this episode of Backwood Belief. And please do check out The Dorian Principle online. Give that book a read. Spread the word about it. Share it around. You can find Backwoods Belief on Twitter, at Backwoods Belief. Ben, what's your Twitter handle?
Bendelwary, at Bendelwary.
And I'm at, I'm at Merely J. Wright. And Conley, are you available on any social media?
I am not on Twitter, but yeah, I'm on pretty active on Facebook and a lot of the Reformed groups.
Okay. All right. So catch Conley on Facebook. Ben, same handle on Gab?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, guys, thank you again for listening. We hope this was profitable. And again, really do hope you'll spread the word about the Dorian Principle. We'll look forward to talking to you very soon out here again in the backwoods. Have a good one. Hey, thanks, Conley. Much appreciated, man.
Yeah, you're welcome.